photos on my phone of like so many memories I had don't even exist anymore. The Gaza that I once knew is essentially gone, but I am more than confident along with my family that we will return and that we will rebuild it.
Well, Seal, deepest condolences on the death of so many family members in Gaza. Seal is a Palestinian student at Rutgers University in New Jersey. I want to thank you for being with us. Rafi Ash, a sophomore in urban studies at Brown University. Duncan Kreps, a graduating senior at Middlebury College. And Alex Marshall, a junior at Evergreen State College in Washington. Coming up, we'll stay with Rutgers and speak to a professor there, one of 60 journalism professors around the country who've signed a letter to the New York Times calling for it to commission an independent review of a controversial December article alleging Hamas systematically weaponized sexual violence on October 7th. Back in 20 seconds.
We shall not be moved, just like the tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved.
Our children.
We're fighting for our children. We shall not be moved. We're fighting for our children. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved.
RISD, Rhode Island School of Design students singing at a vigil last night while they barricaded themselves inside a campus building which they renamed Fathi Rabin Hall after the acclaimed Palestinian artist who died after being unable to get care in Gaza. Special thanks to Democracy Now! Fellow Eric Halverson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than journalism professors around the United States have written to the New York Times calling on the paper to commission an independent review of its report that members of Hamas committed widespread sexual violence on October 7th. Numerous media outlets have raised questions about the paper's reporting, which was written in part by a freelance Israeli journalist, or reported by her, who had liked multiple posts on social media advocating for violence against Palestinians. Last week, Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to one of the letter's signatories, Rutgers University Journalism and Media Studies Professor Deepa Kumar, author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, 20 Years After 9/11. I began by asking her what prompted the letter.
Basically, after this particular article screams without words how Hamas weaponized sexual violence on October 7th came out, there have been numerous reports that have debunked its primary claims. And several journalism professors started to talk about what it means for the New York Times to run a piece like this, even though its key claims have been debunked. And so a group of journalism professors got together and crafted this letter to the New York Times to, as you say, set up an investigative, an independent investigation of how the story was reported, written, and published. And at the center of the controversy, really, is how the two freelancers who were recruited, particularly Anat Schwartz, who's not a journalist at all. She's an Israeli filmmaker and an intelligence officer for the a former Israeli officer for the Air Force. And she has no experience doing journalism. She's recruited to do this story. And what The Intercept, for instance, and Jeremy Scahill, you've had him on the show to talk about the story, what they have shown is how she went around trying to find evidence for the claim that there was systematic violence against women on October 7th and couldn't find any. She phones Israeli hospitals, rape crisis centers, rape crisis hotlines, and she couldn't find any evidence. And so she turns to more dubious sources in order to actually create this story. And this is in her own words, right? They are quoting Anat Schwartz in her own words. And I encourage viewers to go check out that story. And so it was very troubling to professors of journalism to see such a shoddy article be published without a retraction or an investigation. And so it became important for us us to write this letter and to send it to the New York Times.
And Deepa, The Intercept had a recent story about how journalists at the New York Times were encouraged to, quote, restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing and to avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinians. Your response to these kinds of guidelines?
Absolutely. I mean, I actually wrote an open letter back in November to the New York Times, really criticizing the very skewed way in which this genocide, this war on Gaza, was being represented. And I had a problem with the way in which the key tag is the Israel-Hamas war. That's deeply problematic for a number of reasons, not least that Hamas is not a country. Gaza is not a country. Gazans do not have an army, a navy, an air force, or nuclear weapons in the way that Israel does. This is a wholesale slaughter of Palestinian people, a genocide in the works. And unfortunately, that has really that right from the get-go, right? And I'm so glad that these memos are showing that this was intentional, right? This was not an accident, that in fact it's been very skewed in its coverage of what is going on. So what's wrong with that phrase is also that by focusing on Hamas and repeatedly putting a spotlight on the tragedy of October 7th, what happens is it suggests that there was no history before October 7th, and the paper is actually justifying the actions of Israel in Gaza from then on. And that's just, you know, completely one-sided, and it's not what journalism is supposed to be. I'll just say one more thing about the Screams Without Words article, and that is that I don't want to come off saying that there was no sexual violence on October 7th. I think that would be a problem. And in fact, the Intercept story does not say that. What it says is that there wasn't a campaign of systematic sexual violence, and that is important. Because in fact, if there was one, that is horrific, isn't it? And in the climate that we're in today, where the gains of the Me Too movement are being rolled back most recently with the sentence being overturned for Harvey Weinstein, it's very important to take women seriously. But I will say this, that this is also a piece of propaganda, right? Because it draws from a narrative that has a much longer history in settler colonial societies, where sexual violence, alleged violence against particularly white women, becomes the basis for genocide. This is true in the United States. Scholars have documented this and researched this quite well, how the alleged rape of white women became the basis from which to slaughter indigenous people, to slaughter Native Americans. This was used also against African Americans. Frederick Douglass talks about the myth of the black rapist, where, you know, alleged sexual violence by black men was used to justify mass lynchings. And unfortunately, this piece in the New York Times is really the latest iteration of this longer narrative that then serves to justify violence.
I wanted to go to a piece in the New York Times. They retracted a part of their December story on March 25th, though, to be clear, they didn't issue a correction. But this is what they wrote. New video has surfaced that undercuts the account of an Israeli military paramedic who said two teenagers killed in the Hamas-led terrorist attack on October 7th were sexually assaulted. The unnamed paramedic from an Israeli commando unit was among dozens of people interviewed for a December 28th article by the New York Times that examined sexual violence on October 7th. He said he discovered the bodies of two partially clothed teenage girls in a home in Kibbutz Be'eri that bore signs of sexual violence. But footage taken by an Israeli soldier who was in Be'eri on October 7th, which was viewed by leading community members in February and by the Times this month, shows the bodies of three female victims fully clothed and with no apparent signs of sexual violence at a home where many residents had believed the assaults occurred. Though it's unclear if the medic was referring to the same scene, residents said that in no other home in Be'eri were two teenage girls killed, and they concluded from the video that the girls had not been sexually assaulted. Again, I was reading an article from the New York Times on March 25th. Professor Deepa Kumar, if you can respond.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that article, Amy. And I also want to reference that the podcast of the New York Times Daily was actually going to do a full episode on the Screams Without Words article. But when they put it through their standard fact check, it didn't pass. So within the New York Times itself, the story did not pass the basic fact check. And then since then, there have been articles like the one you just mentioned, as well as some corrections, if you will, that have taken place. But in response to our letter, we have heard nothing from the editorial board of the New York Times. And I understand that a New York Times a spokesperson told the Washington Post that they stand by the story. So it's pretty clear that they are not interested in actually holding an investigation and moving away from this really shoddy piece of journalism.
I also wanted to read from Ynet, the news source in Israel, with a headline, New York Times cuts ties with Israeli reporter over alleged policy violation. American newspaper ends Anat Schwartz's employment after liking pro-Israel posts on social media, including one that called to turn Gaza into a slaughterhouse, sparking calls from pro-Palestinian groups to review her employment. Again, she was one of the authors of this December 28th New York Times piece, Deepa Kumar.
Yes, she was, in fact, the key person gathering the information along with her partner's nephew on the ground. And Jeffrey Gettleman is the one who actually—he's a New York Times journalist, award-winning, I might add, who actually wrote the story. And I'll just say very quickly something about Gettleman, which is that at one interview with Sheryl Sandberg, he actually questioned what evidence was, saying that evidence is a legal term, and it's not something that journalists apparently look for, which is just bizarre. These are the basics of any—you go to a J school, and this is what they teach you. You have to have evidence. You have to fact check. And so, you know, it's just shocking. We've also heard from journalists inside the New York Times saying how happy they are that this letter was sent, because they describe the climate inside the New York Times as a very stifling environment, one which is very tightly controlled, you know, so much for free speech, so much for the newspaper of record. And I just want to say that the reason that many of us argue and criticize the New York Times is not because we think that the New York Times is worse than the New York or, you know, Fox News or whatever. You know, those news media outlets don't even pretend to be neutral, to be objective, and so on. Whereas the New York Times does. The New York Times says it adheres to the standards of professional journalism. And here we have such an out-and-out propaganda story that, you know, they have just dug their heels in around in terms of allowing for an investigation, much less retracting the story.
Deepa, what about the current student protests and the push at all these campuses for divestment from Israel of the university endowments? How the Times has been covering these student movements from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I'll first say that these movements are incredible. This is the largest protest movement, solidarity movement with Palestine that I have seen in my lifetime, in over 30 years of being an activist. And this is probably the biggest movement in support of Palestinians in the history of the United States. And for those of us who've been to these encampments, we know that the atmosphere there is peaceful until the police show up and start to create chaos. So, for instance, I was at the University of Pennsylvania encampment last Friday, where two Israeli-born scholars, Omar Bartov and Raz Siegel, were saying, what is anti-Semitism? And there was a fantastic discussion going on. The people at the encampment were so diverse, black, brown, white, Muslim, Jewish, and so on. The only disruptor that I saw was a person identified as a rabbi who came with a sign saying Mein Kampf, right? This is a play on Hitler's famous book, calling those at the encampment, you know, Nazis by extension. And he tried to shut it down, and he was gently told to leave. I mean, Raz Siegel actually asked him to come and speak, but he preferred to actually, scream at the protesters. So that's our experience of going to encampments. These are fantastic spaces of learning. And not just, you know, talking about the history of the region and talking about anti-Semitism, but as growing as human beings, as of being decent human beings with empathy and solidarity with the oppressed. I mean, that's what a university is for, right? There's been music, there's been dancing, there's been poetry reading, and none of that spirit is captured either in the New York Times or in other newspapers who, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. That's what we're seeing. And I want to say, though, also that what is particularly troubling is that the Times, as well as other newspapers, are going with the charges coming from politicians, from congressional figures, that these encampments are anti-Semitic. That could not be further from the truth. There is so little evidence presented to actually validate this point. Instead, what they turn to is that the protesters have slogans which say, from the river to the sea, Palestinians will be free. Now, some have chosen to interpret this as a call for genocide against Jewish Israelis. The only way you could actually reach that conclusion is if you actually have a settler colonial mentality. Remember, of course, that in 1977, in their election platform, the Likud party had exactly such a slogan. They want an Israeli state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. And for them, that means genocide. It means displacement. It means ethnic cleansing. That's not what the protesters are saying. What the protesters are saying is that we want freedom for Palestinians. We want human rights and democracy from the river to the sea. Because what occurs to me when people oppose the slogan is, where exactly do you want Palestinians to be unfree from the river to the sea? So central to this slogan, which is not at all anti-Semitic, is really the charge to end apartheid. It is to create a free, democratic, whatever you want to call it, Israel-Palestine, in this region where Israelis and Palestinians can live side by side. And this is possible.
Rutgers University Journalism and Media Studies Professor Deepu Kumar speaking to us from Philadelphia. Coming up, an historic case against the U.S. military contractor CACI ends in mistrial. It's around the notorious Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal. Stay with us.
I don't mean to blow your high. Pull these strings like Yo-Yo Ma. The end is near, it is something that we can't outrun. Pull your soul out your chest quick like Shao Kahn. I mean Shang Tsung. You want the galaxy in your hand, no Samsung. But your arm's too short to box, so you use handguns. Make a monster for the world so yous can hang them. Bonus, I focus on the moment. Even though dead child lie where my phone is. Algorithms can't search the Day of Atonement. I'm a strong
American Karma by Narsi and Todd Rundgren. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Virginia, a historic case against the U.S. military contractor CACI, used to be called CACI, brought by three Iraqi survivors of torture at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, has ended in mistrial after the jury last week failed to reach a unanimous verdict. The lawsuit against CACI was first filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights in 2008. Since then, CACI repeatedly attempted to have the case dismissed. The plaintiffs, Suhail al-Shamari, Assad Zubai, and Salah al-Ijali, had accused CACI of conspiring to commit war crimes at Abu Ghraib. The three were subjected to sexual abuse, other forms of torture. We interviewed one of the plaintiffs, Salah al-Ijali, on Democracy Now! 10 years ago in 2014. He talked about his time in solitary confinement at Abu Ghraib.
يعني قضايا التحقيق كانت التحقيق التي كانت تحدث كل يومين أو ثلاثة أيام يستمر التحقيق لساعة ساعة ونص.
These interrogations that happened every two or three days would last for an hour and a half or 2 hours in this manner. The details of the interrogations were different. In some cases they would bring dogs, then start the interrogation. In other cases they'd put you in a place and throw cold water or hot tea on you, then start the interrogation. But of course all the interrogations were conducted while you were kept naked and hooded, and they'd ask you questions to which you answer. I stayed for 40 days in a solitary cell, and 70% of that time I was kept naked.
Salah al-Ijali, one of the plaintiffs in the case against the U.S. military contractor CACI, or CACI, for torture at Abu Ghraib. For more on the case, I spoke with Bahar Azmi, legal director for the rights representing the Abu Ghraib plaintiffs in the case. I began by asking him to talk about the significance of the mistrial and the importance of the case.
Thank you, Amy, for paying attention to this case for over 15 years. This is a historic human rights case. Say it's among the many dozens, maybe even hundreds of cases brought trying to challenge U.S. torture practices in U.S. courts. This is the first and only time torture survivors have come to United States court and been able to actually testify about what happened to them. And all three did and provided just heartbreaking and powerful testimony that is a credit to their remarkable courage and resilience over these 15 years, facing every obstacle that these powerful interests have put before them. But they were able to tell their story, and even though the jury ultimately was not unanimous, what became clear is, you know, the jury would send out questions to the court periodically after the testimony was finished that gave us pretty strong clues about what was holding them up. And what was very clear is, first, nobody seemed to question the reliability of their testimony, the fact that they, in fact, suffered torture or treatment, and nobody seemed to question the fact that CACI interrogators, CACI interrogators, were in a conspiracy with the military police, many of whom we know were court-martialed for the abuses at Abu Ghraib, and that that conspiracy existed between CACI interrogators and military police that produced the exact same harms that our clients suffered. The mistrial ultimately turned on a legal question that was very, very confusing for the jurors. They asked about it three times in court and ultimately revealed they can't figure out what the meaning of this legal question is.
Explain.
Yeah, so among the grab bag of deflections and defenses CACI has thrown out over the past 15 years, most recently they've invoked this, 18th century doctrine called the borrowed servant doctrine, which in theory suggests if an employer completely relinquishes control of their employees to another entity, even if their employees in that other entity do unlawful acts, you know, CACI would not be responsible. And the jury was confused about the level of control because while CACI, of course, hired, was able to fire, discipline, and supervise them, all of the indicia of employment, sure, they were performing work for the Army. what the jury was not told is CACI would be liable if there's a kind of joint control. So some probably were confused and thinking, well, they're following directions by the Army and the others. We actually know from the AP reporting that a majority of the eight jurors agreed with plaintiffs, recognized the obvious, which is these were CACI employees subject to CACI employment policies, and therefore the company should be responsible for what their employees were doing.
Instead of
nobody being responsible. I mean, this just means that because, you know,
they were basically working for the U.S. military. Doesn't this give governments enormous deniability because they can order people what to do? They work for a subcontractor and then it's a no man's land.
It is a no man's land. And I think the way the court structured the legal theory, it would make any government contractor theoretically immune, because any government contractor loans out their employees to the client, the United States government, to perform work. And that exacerbates this accountability gap, which, as I said before, recall, military police officers, the co-conspirators with CACI interrogators, were marshaled and punished and served time. They testified in this trial, and like the military generals, two of them who did reports in 2004, these military police fingered CACI interrogators and said, yeah, they told us to treat detainees like to soften up detainees for interrogations, and we were in a brotherhood with them and carried out their instructions that led to these abuses.
Okay, we're talking about a scandal that broke 20 years ago, those famous pictures that came out, for example, in the New Yorker magazine, Cy Hirsch's piece. You've been on this case for over 15 years. How come this took so long?
Well, I think when you are litigating against a massively resourced and with $8 billion, they will do everything to delay justice as long as possible. And they've tried. They filed over 24 motions to dismiss. In many cases, they're just one or two. We've been to the Court of Appeals five times. They've tried to get Supreme Court review. That's their effort to block any kind of accountability. And what they could not stop is three courageous human beings who stood up against every obstacle and told their story in a U.S. court in a breathtaking, compelling manner. And while we didn't get a judgment from a jury, we got historical testimony that makes clear, I think, CACI's responsibility for these clients' harms.
So tell us about these individuals, these three men. We heard one man describing a part of his experience. Mm-hmm. Talk about what they endured at Abu Ghraib and why they were even imprisoned.
Well, in the chaos following the invasion, the United States swept up thousands of Iraqi citizens and detained them in detention camps all over Iraq. The one we know most about is Abu Ghraib, a notorious torture facility from Saddam regime. And in that chaos, there was a command vacuum. CACI interrogators sort of took over and started ordering MPs, military police, who were basically prison guards, to abuse detainees in advance of the interrogations CACI would undertake. And our clients suffered the kinds of abuses everyone suffered: beatings, forced nudity, sexual humiliation, religious degradation. And they talked so powerfully about what that experience was to them. Salah, who we saw, talked about what it was like to be chained and naked among so many other naked men and not being able to make eye contact with others because that would just exacerbate their shame. Assad talked about the first night there being chained, hooded, naked in a freezing isolation cell, crying out for help, and having to urinate on himself because they deliberately would not come to him. Suhail, who is a middle school principal, talked about his forced nudity and the indignity. He said, "I am a principal. I am a man." And to suffer that level of degradation was really, really painful for them, and just enormous credit to their courage to come to a United States court and speak about it.
Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing three Abu Ghraib plaintiffs in their lawsuit against the U.S. military contractor CACI, also known as CACI. To see the full interview, go to democracynow.org. That does it for our show, our video and audio podcasts. You can get them wherever you get your podcasts. Now is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Gokuduz, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tara Sena, Tammy Warnoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tay Maria Astudio, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sorry to interrupt. I know you're busy enjoying one of your favorite shows on CJSF. But it's me, Robin, host of Roots and Berries on Fridays at noon. And I'm here with a very special delivery. Thank you for listening to CJSF.